I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. In April 1882, a Kansas City mob chased down and lynched Levi Harrington. 136 years later, a historical marker now stands on city land to remember him. It's Missouri's first lynching memorial. Today we'll find out how it came to be and what we know about the man it commemorates. More of these memorials are being erected around the country, and some connect these killings to modern death penalty cases. Then, municipal leaders looking to combat climate change are gathering this weekend. They'll hear about practices that cities and counties can use now to battle this threat. But how far will those efforts go without support at the federal level? We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. We've talked on this program before about lynchings that took place in Missouri and Kansas years ago. Across the country, more than 4,400 African Americans were victims of racial terrorism and lynching between 1877 and 1950. Most communities have said or done nothing to acknowledge their local history of lynching, and many victims of racial terror and the trauma of those atrocities have been largely ignored. That changed in Kansas City last weekend when several groups came together to erect the first historical marker to acknowledge the lynching of Mr. Levi Harrington, who was killed in West Kansas City back on April 3, 1882. Now, more about what happened that day and why. With us, Jerry Sanders is an archivist with the Black Archives of Mid-America. Jerry, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thank you.
Stacy Pratt is with Missourians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty. Stacy, good morning.
Good morning to you.
Michelle Tyrene Johnson is a reporter with KCUR 89.3. Michelle, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Well, Jerry Sanders, you know, Levi Harrington died 136 years ago. That's a long time. I mean, why is it so important to remember him even today?
One of the reasons it's so important to remember him today is the fact that we learn from the past. And because of that, it's going to be very important for us to teach the future what it is that happened in the past so that we can, you know, bring some type of healing.
Yeah. Stacy, what would you add to that?
I think it's one of the critical things that we must understand as a society, that our history shapes our present. And I think that the day that we all came together to acknowledge Mr. Harrington, there was a true understanding that the history of Missouri and our country has been repeated in many ways in our modern criminal justice system. So yeah, we must learn from our history and acknowledge it.
You know, Michelle, this idea of recalling the victims of terrorist lynching is picking up steam in this country. There's a new National Memorial for Peace and Justice down in Montgomery, Alabama, dedicated to these victims from across the nation. How significant is this?
I mean, it's big. I mean, there's a concept in social justice called truth and reconciliation, which is a big part of what this is. And Germany has done it. South Africa has done it. It's a way of reckoning your past as a part of apologizing, recognizing, and creating a better present and future. And that's what this is about, I think. Yeah. It's truth and reconciliation.
You know, likewise, the memorial to Levi Harrington is the first in Missouri to a lynching victim. What impact do you think this is going to have?
Based on what I've seen and heard just in the short time since the story ran and, you know, attending the memorial service for a bit, people are talking about lynching in our history in a way. I mean, people are always, I don't understand why, but are always struck anew at how bad things used to be,
mm-hmm,
and how recently bad things happened.
Mm-hmm.
They're always very surprised.
Stacy, do you think, what impact are you seeing out there and hearing out there as you get around town?
You know, I think it's been profound. I've talked to so many people who are active in racial justice work and across the community who said to me, I had no idea that there was a lynching in Kansas City. And one of the profound things that I think is happening is now there's been a public recognition on the part of the mayor and the Jackson County executive, who issued proclamations tying this act of racial terror in Kansas City to our current challenges with mass incarceration and capital punishment. We know these things are racially disproportionate. There are 65 individuals in Missouri facing either a death sentence or a pending capital case. They are disproportionately African American, and that tells us a story. We know that the counties in Missouri that engaged heavily in lynching are the same counties that are engaging in capital punishment disproportionately.
Today.
And I think that reality is one that is a wake-up call to all of us. I think there is this desire sometimes to see the horror of the past as being beyond our current reality. The fact is, it definitely shapes our current reality, and that the soil that's filled with blood, which is Mr. Harrington's blood and 60 others across the state of Missouri, has really sprung forth our current system of criminal justice.
You know, Jerry, this connection between the past and present that Stacey just outlined, that's just astonishing to me.
It is, and I think that people don't realize how important it is to remember the past.
Mm-hmm.
Last night, I watched an HBO special about Sandra Bland, and it says, say her name. And I think that this is what we need to do mm-hmm. with the 60 victims that have been identified in Missouri as being lynched between 1877 and 1950. Mm-hmm. We need to stop and say their names. So the remembrance part and the reconciliation go hand in hand, because the only way we can reconcile is to remember.
Well, let's say the name of Levi Harrington. And Jerry, what do we know about him and what happened to him that day?
What I know about what happened to him is that he just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Which is the story for so many African-American victims here.
Yes, he was trying to peacefully, I think, eat a lunch or a dinner, and the mob came up on him.
And why did the mob form? Tell us what was going on.
Well, at that particular time, there was two African-Americans that were just kind of strolling by the home of a police officer, a white police officer. And there was a conversation between the police officer and another gentleman that maybe they might be up to no good. So they started to pursue them. And when they did that, one of those gentlemen shot and killed the white police officer. And when he did, a mob formed, and they went looking for the person who did the shooting.
The perpetrator.
Yes.
Yeah. And they came across Levi Harrington.
Yes. And when Levi saw the mob, he ran.
As anybody might be inclined to do at a moment like that.
Yes.
Yeah. What happened then?
Well, they caught up with him.
Mm-hmm.
And then they lynched him from the Bluff Street Bridge. As you know, bridges were a common place to hold lynchings.
Is that where the memorial to Mr. Harrington is today?
No, the memorial is up in the Ermine.
It's West Terrace Park near the Ermine Case Park.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, do we know what happened to the real cop killer, the man named George Grant back in the day?
Yes, we do. He actually was tried three separate times from newspaper articles that I uncovered. Huh. And he only went to jail for 2 years for that crime.
What do you make of that?
I can't.
Because that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, you would think that maybe somebody would have wanted to drag him out of jail and lynch him as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But nothing happened to him.
If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking about the lynching of Mr. Levi Harrington back in 1882 and a new memorial, the first in Missouri to commemorate his death. Stacey Pratt, how did the memorial come to be, and how did all that happen?
You know, my organization, as well as folks from the Black Archives like Jerry Sanders and Glenn North, got together to discuss the importance of having a marker. And actually, you know, we've been working for several months, almost a year, with the Equal Justice initiative in Alabama. And in fact, we're partners with them in this effort. I think one of their goals is to bring about truth and reconciliation. And I had the good fortune to attend the opening of that museum.
I was going to say, you've been down there and I've seen photographs. We've done shows here. The photographs are pretty moving. Describe what they have as a memorial to lynching victims.
It's incredibly powerful. In April of last year, we collected soil for Mr. Harrington, which is now on display at the museum in Alabama. And their goal is to collect soil for all the lynching victims across the country, including Missouri. Mm-hmm. And in addition, they're hoping to erect markers. You know, our marker is only the 12th in the nation. I think EJI is hoping communities will embrace this process of soil collection, marker dedication, and hopefully bringing home monuments from our county to engage in a true community conversation. It goes beyond the moment of acknowledgement, which is profound and necessary. But I think about the idea of penance. You know, first we must acknowledge what we've done wrong. We have to sit with that, acknowledge it, but then we must truly reform what we're doing in our practices. And so that's part of what we did.
What groups came together to put this monument in the ground?
There were so many, and we're very blessed in that sense. Parks and Rec did a wonderful job supporting this effort. The Black Archives of Mid-America, the Missouri NAACP, Missourians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty, leaders from the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and prominent individuals in the community have also supported this work, as well as partnering directly with EJI. And they came to town for it, too.
I'm wondering if you can tell us about the ceremony on Saturday. You know, what happened, Stacy? How many people were there? Tell us about that.
It was one of the most moving ceremonies I've ever been to. Mm. The weather was somber. It was cold and it was rainy. And we had anticipated a crowd of maybe 100 people. In fact, it looked like there ended up being more like 150. Mm. All the chairs were taken. People were on the sidelines. And it was very somber, as it was appropriate. But I was struck by people's willingness to stay and witness. You know, one of the moments that was quite profound for me in the ceremony is Reverend Dr. Cassandra Gould from Missouri Faith Voices was doing a ritual of healing and remembrance. Mm-hmm. And she asked us all to touch the soil that was tainted with the blood of all the folks whose lives have been taken through racial terror.
You know, Levi was a father of five?
Five children.
Five children. He was a good guy from what I read about him. Is that match what you know?
From most of the newspaper articles that I looked at, he was a very good man. His former employers wanted to give money to the family. They even wrote to the Kansas City Times to ask people to give donations to the family because if it had been someone else that this had occurred, another white person, then maybe the community would have come out to support him.
How much of an uproar at that time was there about the fact that this had taken place in our town?
You know, there wasn't much of an uproar. It actually occurred on the same day that Jesse James was shot.
Well, you're kidding. Which means the story determined the newspaper business as it got buried.
It got buried.
Yeah.
And about 2 days later, it did start to show up in some of the African-American newspapers across the country.
Mm-hmm. We have a phone call here from Eric up in St. Joseph. Eric, welcome to Up to Date. We're talking about a lynching memorial, new one, in here in Kansas City. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Well, thank you.
I've got a question for you. I'd just like a little clarification from your guest there, because if I heard right, the comparison was made between capital punishment and lynching. When one has gone through the legal system and been convicted and a legal, you know, process, when the other is an unruly mob and completely illegal, and I don't understand the connection, I don't understand the comparison between capital punishment and lynching when I feel like there's two totally different, totally unrelated and unconnected things.
Stacey Pratt, take a run at that if you would.
You know, I'd be happy to answer that question. You know, one of the things that's troubling and fascinating is that the process of developing a court system and a legal system to impose death sentences in the state of Missouri and elsewhere grew up around the lynching, the uproar nationally around the practice of lynching. And so in many cases, we have documentation where individuals who were set to be lynched, people stopped the mob and said, look, we'll lynch, we will go through a court process, which may last all of a day, and take the life tomorrow. The sad reality of what we know from looking at Missouri's history is that the regions in our state which have engaged heavily in lynching also embrace capital punishment. And the deep question is there really a completely flawless court process that comes up with a situation where we're dealing with folks who are truly guilty of a crime, and if that crime is really one that should result in this type of punishment. And what we know is this. The Washington Supreme Court recently invalidated all capital punishment because it was so racially biased in its application. When we look at the institutions of government, we must ask the question, are they so deeply tainted by racial bias that we can no longer trust them? I have met myself two men who live in Kansas City, African-American men, who are on Missouri's death row for over two decades, both innocent men who were convicted by a system that was incredibly racially biased, with all white juries and prosecutors who hid evidence. I think that's why this conversation is so important. When we look at the history of lynching, you know, the newspapers from that time period said Mr. Harrington was a colored man, and that was enough for the mob to take his life. And we have to stop and pause and look at if our capital punishment system is not doing the same. We know that there are 65 folks in Missouri facing pending cases for capital sentences or on death row. Over 35% of them are African American, when African Americans are only 11% of our population.
Eric, I hope that helped.
No, it doesn't really. I feel like we're on two sides of this issue here, but your phrase lawless court system, I find, you know, kind of a contradictory phrase. And then to say that the court system arose out of lynching, when lynching is not a trial, not a legal system. It's a mob of people deciding on the moment, on the spot. That's not a legal system, and nothing arose out of that. No legal system arose out of lynching. That doesn't make any sense. But you have
Give me one more response to that, if you would, Stacey, and then we're going to move on.
Yeah, actually, there's a great analysis that shows exactly that the criminal justice system in Missouri, particularly capital punishment, rose up around the practice of lynching. It's been verified in a number of articles, which I'd be happy to share later.
Michelle, a poet in town named Glenn North wrote a poem for the dedication last weekend. Tell us about that.
Actually, he didn't write it specifically for the dedication. Huh. Glenn is a poet, really gifted and renowned poet, who had written this for another occasion, but it was inspired by seeing a painting about lynching, and that's what inspired his poem.
Well, let's listen to Glenn North reading his poem, Lynch Family Blues.
Went out swinging last night, baby. Hope you didn't wait up for me. Said I was swinging all night, baby. Did you stay up late for me? I wasn't swinging in no joint, darling. I was out on the limb of a tree. Now I'm walking on air, baby. Feels almost like I'm free. My feet steady kicking the wind. Yeah, I'm close to being free. And for the first time in my life, baby, white folks is looking up to me. Hear me, son. Your daddy loves you. Keep hanging on to hope. You the man of the house now. Gotta help your mama cope. Daddy won't be coming home no more. 'Cause I reached the end of my rope.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. You know, Jerry, the work on the Levi Harrington case isn't over. You're still working on it. I'm wondering, what are you doing?
I'm trying to go through a lot of the archives, census records, newspaper articles, to find out if I can eventually find his family, the descendants of his family.
You had any luck yet?
Actually, I haven't, but I do have a new lead. I'll just keep that under wraps until I can, flesh it out a little more.
You know, Michelle, the answer may be obvious, but why has it taken 100 years to get to this point with these memorials here in town and elsewhere?
Oh, our country loves to be in denial about how deep the scars of race go. I mean, if you think about how current talks of racism involving things that happened yesterday, last week, if you look at how difficult, how contentious, how bad those conversations can go quickly, especially on social media, it's not a reach to see that people really don't want to bring up or talk about racial horrors from the past. And in fact, on the story that ran on our website, one of the people who commented said, "I don't understand why it's okay to keep up why it's okay to attack the existence of Confederate monuments, but we can put up a memorial to lynching victims." His point was because it just creates resentment. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I didn't respond, but my response to that, if I had a conversation with the person, is, but who's feeling the resentment? Whose resentment are you worried about? Because fear of resentment shouldn't be why we have those real, authentic conversations.
Are there other memorials scheduled for the Kansas City area, Stacy? What are you seeing out there?
Actually, I think there is. One of our goals as a community is to actually bring back a monument to Levi Harrington that is currently in the National Memorial for Peace and Justice. So these are 8 to 10 feet tall brass pillars that contain individual county names. Hmm. And one of the ideas that I think is important here is that there's an expectation that we will embrace our history, and that those counties in America that have done that community work will be prioritized for taking those memorials from Alabama and bringing them home as a sign that we have gotten there in terms of at least the step of telling the truth, which, as folks know, is really a difficult step.
You know, the last time I checked, we know about 60 lynchings in Missouri, about 19 in Kansas. Are those numbers match what you guys are looking at out there, or do you expect the numbers to rise as more research is completed here?
I actually expect those numbers to rise. I think that this was a preliminary search that was done by EJI that helped to identify. But when I was in college years ago, I did a couple of studies, and I'm still looking for those names on that list. So I do believe that there's far more than we could ever imagine.
And I think it should be noted that Missouri has the second highest number of lynchings outside of the South. So, I mean, Missouri has a significant number compared to most states in the Union.
Yeah, you just took my next point right there.
I'm sorry.
No, that's quite okay. But that point's worth emphasizing. Right. Missouri has a second highest had the second highest number of lynching during this period between slavery and the Jim Crow era. That's quite a legacy.
Outside of the South.
Yeah. Wow.
And I think it's important to know, too, that the impact of lynching was not just on the individual who was lynched, that this was a tool of racial terror to keep everyone else down. And so knowing how much of that has permeated our history really calls us to question where we are.
Hmm. Do we know when the last lynching occurred in Missouri?
I think it was in the 1940s.
I was going to say, that's my guess, too, from my conversation about that the last time. So not that long ago, World War II.
Not that long ago. Mm-mm.
Yeah. Okay. Well, listeners can hear Michelle Tyrene Johnson's story about the Levi Harrington Memorial at kcur.org. It's headlined, "Kansas City Erects First Memorial to Remember a Victim of Lynching." I want to thank Michelle for coming in. Always appreciate it, Michelle.
Thank you.
Stacy Pratt is with Missourians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty. Stacy, appreciate
thank
it.
You.
Jerry Sanders is an archivist with the Black Archives of Mid-America. She's still working on this case. Good luck with your sleuthing. I hope you have good success.
Thank you.
Time for a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about what local leaders are doing about global warming. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday on the show, Kansas City was listed among the must-see destinations for 2019 by National Geographic Traveler. You can hear how we made the cut and catch other previous episodes. You'll find them at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, after a decade of tuba Christmas concerts, the Kansas City Symphony aims to make history this weekend. This year's performance looks to break the record for largest tuba ensemble. You can find out what it'll take to pull this off tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, we've got a decade that is to get global climate change under control, or the hope of holding global warming to moderate levels goes out the window. With the federal government rolling back Obama-era climate measures, state and local leaders are stepping forward to do what they can and what their cities and states can to battle this issue. On Saturday, local leaders from across the metro are gathering to learn about ways to combat and reverse the impacts of climate change upon the greater Kansas City area. Local elected officials organized the workshop, but how much of a difference will these local efforts make without the full involvement of the federal government? Let's find out. With us are Lindsay Constance. She's a council member out in Shawnee. Lindsay, welcome. Nice to have you.
Hi. Thank you so much for having us.
Mike Kelly is the new mayor of Prairie Village. Mike, congratulations. Nice to have you here.
Thank you very much, Steve. I'm actually the mayor of Roland Park.
Kansas. Roland Park. I don't know what happened here. We'll fix it.
It's no problem.
Who put this workshop together?
Lindsay and I put this workshop together. I'll kind of let her start.
Lindsay, what happened there?
You know, so in October, when the recent IPCC report came out and it said we have just over a decade to take significant action to solving climate change, for me, it felt really personal. I have a daughter who just started kindergarten this year. And when I think ahead to 2030, that's the year she's supposed to graduate from high school.
So in her lifetime, the problems might really come unraveled here.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, when my daughter graduates, I want to know that she's got a world of possibilities open to her. I'm also a teacher in the Shawnee Mission School District. And so I also thought about it just in conjunction with the students I work with. We're trying to prepare them for the world. And so I felt like it was incredibly important for local leaders to get together and discuss solutions so that these kids have a future.
Mayor, how many folks do you think are going to attend this thing this weekend?
Well, right now we've got over 120 local elected officials spanning both sides of the state line, spanning all levels of local government, from state senators to state representatives, fellow mayors, city councilors.
120.
120, and we're still receiving registrations
today. That's impressive to me.
Well, I think people see the necessity here. Like Lindsay said, the IPCC report, and then just recently, the Friday after Thanksgiving, the fourth iteration of the National Climate Assessment came out, and those 11 federal agencies made it starkly clear for us that not only our environment, but our economy is tied to the challenges that climate change is going to bring to us unless we take immediate, extensive action.
Do you think people are finally waking up to the threat here? You know, what are you seeing, Lindsay? Is it finally starting to happen? Because my sense is it's happened, but really not to the extent that maybe it needs to really get serious about this.
Well, I think the urgency definitely encourages leaders to take action. Absolutely. I think previous to this, both Mike and I have always been involved and interested in this issue. But even myself, I was assuming it was a few decades in the future. So this really just kind of upped the timeline. I also think that folks are hesitant to take action because of the overwhelming scale of the problem, and they're just not sure what to do. So again, this is about bringing leaders together to learn about the solutions and then see what can come of it.
And that's what's really exciting about this workshop, is that we're not talking just about the doom and gloom that climate change might bring, but we're framing this in the terms of opportunities. We're going to be hearing from cities, including Mayor Sly James, but also Governor Martin O'Malley, a former governor of Maryland, about how they have implemented these solutions and have had great success in their communities. So there are opportunities there to innovate and to collaborate amongst the metro area. And that's what we're excited about presenting, is not only the opportunities of what we can do within our each individual small municipalities, but what we might be able to do together as a metro area.
Do you think the fact, Mayor, that there's a deadline out there, does that begin to change the mindset? Because, you know, as Lindsay was saying, there's always been this sense this is a problem in the far distant future. Suddenly, it's not.
Yeah, I think that has an effect on it as well. And I think Kansas Cityans are realizing that we're not immune from the consequences of these actions. People think of climate change and how it might affect the coast in California or hurricanes in southeast Florida. But recently, scientists put together what's called the Climate Disruption Index, and they ranked, using their metrics, what metropolitan areas might feel the effects of climate change the most.
This is going to shock people, what you're about to say, I think.
Yeah, Kansas City was ranked as the fifth city most likely to feel the effects of climate change. You think about...
Again, we think of this as a problem elsewhere. It's not.
No, it's very much in our backyards. We are on the front lines of the climate change battle. Heat index days, drought in western Kansas. You think about the Ogallala Aquifer. You think about... just the heat degree days, we're having extreme weather. This is very much a Kansas City problem, but that's why we're excited to bring people together to find Kansas City solutions.
I'm wondering, you know, Lindsay, the purpose of this conference, this workshop this weekend is going to be what? What do you hope comes out of this thing?
You know, we kind of came up with a goal, which we said was to inspire action in the Kansas City metro, grounded in the understanding that we know what to do, we have the means to make it happen, and in the process, we'll be creating a more sustainable, healthy, and equitable community. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the overall goal leading us into Saturday. You know, really, I don't want to put the workshop into a box and say that we're going to have XYZ as our answer, because what I know is the number of impressive people we have coming together to learn and dialogue around this, I think even better ideas than Mike and I could come up with are going to come out of this workshop.
Yeah,
so this is for me about learning. And I think I approached this as an educator, knowing how important it is for us to have facts and data and solutions. So I just want us together to learn more.
Absolutely. And we've already been pleasantly surprised by the amount of elected officials and county officials that have wanted to take part in this workshop. So it is already... beyond our hopes in terms of the number of people and the amount of residents that would be represented by this group. But I think Lindsay and I agreed that this is the beginning and not the end of our conversation here. We're hoping to see what organically comes out of this, but also to take collective action in the near future. You know, other metro areas or regions have formed regional compacts. I mentioned Southeast Florida has a four-county area that works together on sustainable and climate resilience issues. The metropolitan area in Boston does something similar. So if we're able to take actions together, that can be economically fortuitous and ecologically beneficial that smaller cities can't do by themselves just based on the realities of staff time and investment. We're excited about what that might be for Kansas City.
How much of a difference can local leaders make? I mean, there's this big question hovering all over all of this with the federal government sort of going what a lot of people would argue is the wrong way on this issue. Can you guys really make a difference?
Oh, absolutely. And while the federal government has kind of advocated leadership here by removing the United States from the Paris Climate Accord right. and taking certain steps to dismantle the EPA, cities are really the climate leaders. And cities have been the leaders of culture and innovation throughout history. Over 55% of the world's population lives in cities. Cities also account for more than 75% of global greenhouse gas emissions. So the opportunity really exists for cities to be the leaders and not to have to wait on the federal government to put a one-size-fits-all program out there.
You know, and I also think to the question of whether local leaders can solve it, I actually agree that we are the ones to solve it because we are most closely linked to our residents. In Shawnee, I represent 17,000 people, and those people are my neighbors. So I can hear directly from them about their ideas and their concerns. And we're also the closest link to the problems. And so I think it's actually cities and states are where we're going to see the most action.
Yeah, there's been some questioning about that because you guys, you know, you can't do much with emission standards and taxes on polluters. Professor Michael Oppenheimer of Princeton was a lead author of climate reports that the UN issued. In an interview with PBS, he said this, and I'm quoting, "An uncoordinated response takes place in hundreds or even thousands of states and localities, just will never get us to where we need to go. This is a problem which needs national leadership." And I'm hearing you guys say that's not the case, Mayor.
No, I don't think so. While we're excited to have some new partners and to have this conversation be reinvigorated on the national level, we think that cities do hold the keys to solving this issue. And a lot of these solutions that we're going to be talking about on Saturday can be directly taken by cities themselves, whether it's some of the more traditional ones that you hear about in solar panels. You know, people don't realize how much more effective that's become at not only a commercial but a residential level. And in preparing residents for solar readiness on their homes can have a big impact. And then wind. You look at Kansas, and we have a huge opportunity, maybe the second greatest in the country, to harness the power of wind energy on a large-scale level, but also micro wind. You think about downtown, and you have those beautiful sculptures on the top of Bartle Hall. There's an opportunity to put micro wind turbines downtown, where you get those steady breezes that can help, you know, power the city.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking this morning about a local workshop taking place this weekend with local leaders aimed at taking steps to combat global climate change. I'm visiting with Mayor Mike Kelly from Roland Park and Lindsay Constance, a council member from Shawnee. Your questions and comments, welcome. 816-235-2888 is our number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. So what kinds of things might you guys come up with? What are some of the potential remedies that are on the table that you're looking at here, Lindsay?
So the solutions range from infrastructure to lifestyle, but the really two main categories are energy and food. And Mike talked some about renewable energy. They are very much in the top 10 of the best solutions to reduce greenhouse emissions.
Taking advantage of Kansas wind, for instance.
Absolutely. Yeah. So those are key solutions. But there's also some other things that you wouldn't necessarily think of right away. You know, also in the top 10 are eating a plant-based diet and reducing food waste. So, you know, that food waste portion is really interesting to learn more about. Actually, uneaten food is responsible for about 8% of global emissions. So if we can
explain, you're not an expert on this, but why does uneaten food cause that?
Absolutely. So the production of the food that doesn't get eaten, it squanders resources from the farm and the utilization of water, as well as, you know, increased methane through farming, through agriculture. And then when that organic matter enters the landfill, if we are not composting it, that also lets out methane gas. So that, again, is 8% of global emissions right there in just wasting food.
That's really interesting.
And I find that interesting because it's also another opportunity. By not wasting food, then that also solves the problem of feeding more people.
You know, the number six on that list, this is from Project Drawdown. We're going to talk about that in a moment. That's provided something of a blueprint for the group meeting this weekend. Number six is educating girls. What's that, Madam Teacher? What's that about?
You know, education really lays a foundation for girls, and then as they become women, to have careers, to contribute. A lot of it has to do with the women who do have more education. They often choose to have fewer children, so it helps with population. And they also have healthier children. So, you know, through those two things, that's really what reduces those emissions. I was equally shocked when I saw educating girls as number six.
Yeah. These are sort of like bank shot ideas. I mean, the rationale behind them, you sort of have to round a corner or two. But once you explain it, it sort of makes sense.
Well, and, you know, the other great thing about these solutions is, you know, they are in and of themselves beneficial. Educating girls, reducing food waste, retrofitting buildings, those make a difference even before we talk about the greenhouse emissions that are saved.
You know, the number one item on the list was refrigerant management. What's that? Mayor, do you have any idea?
Yeah. So the chemicals that have been used for air conditioning and for refrigerants account for large portions of greenhouse emissions. And recently, those have been phased out starting in the 1970s. They started to phase out certain chemicals, but especially in developing countries, they're still using refrigerants that have a large greenhouse emissions output. So, you know, everybody across the world needs opportunity to live in a comfortable environment. So you just think about the large scale that refrigerants have across the world. And by switching to a more renewable chemical makeup, that can have a huge impact on the amount of emissions.
Spoken like a true scientist, by the way, Mayor. You're wearing multiple hats here today. I appreciate that.
Well, I don't pretend to be a scientist. I believe science, and I believe in scientists. But at the same time, I'm understanding the necessity of the problem. And I was elected to be a leader like Lindsay. And I know that there's not only a challenge, but a huge opportunity for our community. And being a sustainability commissioner for Roland Park, but also a guy that likes the outdoors. You know, I'm an Eagle Scout, and I'm proud to say that I've always tried to adhere to the adage of leave it better than you found it.
We're talking about how local leaders can combat climate change, a local conference taking place in the metro this weekend. 816-235-2888 is our number. Jay from Overland Park, you're on the air.
Hi. I live in Overland, well, as you mentioned, live in Overland Park, and our homeowners association won't allow for solar panels. Mm. And it reminds me of years ago when we had to have shingles. Eventually, Overland Park passed a law that said homeowners associations can't restrict shake shingles. You could have asphalt shingles, and fewer houses are burning down now. If something could be done about the solar panels so that that was allowed, I think we could do a lot to make improvements. I'd love to do it myself, but right now I can't.
Hmm. What should he do?
Well, that's a really interesting question to bring
yes,
up.
It is.
It's something that residents in my homeowners association have been asking about because it's also restricted in our covenant. So it's really one of those problems we've been discussing and also reaching out to our state representatives on ways in which we can make our state more solar friendly.
Wait, could state action solve something like this?
Well, I believe so.
And I think local action can solve this. One of the speakers that we're going to be lucky enough to hear from is Tom Jacobs, who's the environmental officer from the Mid-America Regional Council. And through the Mid-America Regional Council, they have a program that cities can participate in for solar readiness, not only helping educate the citizens about what an investment in solar might look like, but also specific steps through ordinances and building codes that cities can undertake to pass an ordinance, hopefully in Overland Park. Roland Park recently went through this process. And Kansas City has an application process as well, so that people can harness that energy that's provided from the sun, free of greenhouse emissions, and also help their pocketbooks a little bit.
Jay, I hope that helps.
Thank you for taking the call.
All the best. Ace from Kansas City, Missouri. Ace, you're on Up to Date.
Thanks, Steve. I'm a local area investor and consultant to a number of very intriguing energy reduction solution companies. As an investor in solar, I'm very delighted to hear people want to do more of that kind of work. However, I want to make the point here that there is much that can be done to reduce the consumption of electricity. One of my clients replaces brand new efficient motors, and KCPL is very supportive of this initiative, but these efficient motors are radically so efficient that they reduce a great deal of the energy that's otherwise being consumed. So finally, on a project that I'm involved with right now to install 250 kilowatts of new solar, very sizable project, just by replacing the motors at this facility, we can save the same amount of kilowattage that we're going to produce on the solar.
Right.
At much less.
Ace, I'm glad you called with that suggestion. You know, I wonder what our utilities can do. I've noticed that I live on the Kansas side. I've been interested in getting an audit of my home to see how energy efficient it is. Well, the utility company doesn't provide that. I have to go out and get a private guy to do it, and it's more expensive. I mean, there are simple things like that that maybe can be done here, right, Lindsay? I mean,
absolutely. You know, some of the solutions do involve energy efficiency, retrofitting, using smart glass, improving insulation. Actually, the city of Shawnee is now going through a facility conservation improvement program in which we look at the operations across the city to see what opportunities we have to save in our energy costs. And then that money can be invested elsewhere in the city for other resident priorities. So I think that is absolutely an important part of the equation.
And that's why we're also excited to have utility board members be a part of the conversation here. I know KCP&L has worked to change its fuel mixture so that they have a higher percentage of renewables. Evergy on the west side of the state line has also moved towards having a larger percentage of their production and generation come out of wind power. And so we're excited to have them be part of that conversation so that the average person, when they turn on their lights and pay their bill to Evergy and KCP&L, will be changing their greenhouse emissions.
We're getting questions from listeners saying, what can you guys do to encourage the utilities to do more, make solar more accessible through PACE loans? I'm not sure what that is. Increase net metering rates, those kinds of things. You're being called to act, I guess, here by some of our listeners here. Leah from Kansas City, Kansas. Good morning.
Hi there. I was wondering if there was any discussion on plasma converters. I know there's pretty good interest on that, on big scales and small scales. I know they use them on cruise ships, and there are some plants around the world that take the trash that people use and turn it into energy to fuel cities.
Plasma converters, what do we know about them? Anything?
Well, I do know that generating energy from waste is one of the solutions in drawdown. But Steve, this is going to have to be one of those times where I say that I am not a scientist and don't necessarily understand the plasma solution that you're, I think it was Leah, has called to talk about. But that's why we're excited to get these elected officials together to learn, to hear from the experts, and hopefully realize that some of these solutions do exist and they're not too far out of our grasp.
Yeah, I'm just wondering what you all hope. Are you going to issue a report after the workshop on Saturday? You know, what's the plan ahead, Lindsay?
Well, the plan ahead is to
keep going.
To just keep going. I mean, again, I'm trying not to box in Saturday. I want to be there. I want to be present. I want to learn. I want to listen to other leaders and their ideas mm-hmm. rather than go in with my own agenda.
Do you want to have a unified approach? Is that one hope here, one goal?
We could potentially have a unified approach, absolutely. But of course, there's going to be cities who have solutions that work better for them. So I mm-hmm. think it's just about us as leaders empowering one another, you know, learning together. And then from there, there will absolutely be next steps that Mike and I will work together to create.
Yeah, there's going to be
Quickly, Mike.
Yeah, opportunities for cities to work together. But yeah, we're looking forward to an opportunity to work together regionally in the future.
Okay, that's Mayor Mike Kelly from Roland Park. Lindsay Constance, a council member in Shawnee. Hey, thank you for sharing all this morning and good luck this weekend. I'd be interested to hear what happens.
Thank you very much.
You bet. Tomorrow on the show, former president of the Kansas State Senate and leader of moderate Republicans, Senator Dick Bond, joins us. Also, two words to pique your interest, Tuba Christmas. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.